Succession number 22084, Reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Keith Potter in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 20th of the 6th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Keith, we were talking the last time about you having reached the ridge. Some of the supplies were getting through, but obviously not quite enough. Can you tell us what happened next?
The first objective, our objective after taking the ridge, was to dig in. And it was very rocky ground, very hard to dig in, and we didn't have a great deal of time, so the trenches were pretty shallow, individual personal weapon pits. And we had, each were issued with three sandbags, which we had to fill with sand to put over a part of the weapon pit to protect us against the anti-personnel shrapnel, because the Germans had got into the, had the trick of firing anti-personnel, which would explode close to the ground, but enough to hit the enemy from the top. So with a shallow trench and three sandbags, you had the choice of whether you had your body exposed while you looked out the front end of the enemy, or you tucked back under the three sandbags in complete darkness, or while any shrapnel might come round.
These are the 88 millimetres that you
Yes, were. And they're very, very... a great weapon, really a very superior weapon, a piece of artillery, infinitely superior to our 28-pounders. Then, after, with the various patrols going out to try and knock out machine guns and that sort of stuff, with first light came the, as I remember, came the first German infantry attack. They came in on armoured vehicles, which swung around and disgorged their contents, the German infantry, who advanced on us. And because at this time we had enough ammunition, we were able to repel, I think we repelled two, perhaps three attacks of that, and we were pretty confident of holding our position. But ammunition, the shortage of ammunition was becoming something of a problem. Now, you would need to understand something of the general battle plan. The battalion had to advance the sufficient distance to take Ruin Ridge. Now, it was 1,000 to 2,000 yards. On the left of us, then, in the morning, would come up a tank battalion on one side and another tank battalion on the other side, a British brigade, I think it was the 169th, something like that, brigade was to come across our front, and it looked easy, but it wasn't, because firstly, with them destroying our support, which was coming up through the tape, through the minefield, and running out of ammunition, we then had to rely on the tanks. The tanks were initially the 50th Tank Battalion, a British regiment. I think I mentioned earlier they're on their way to Fort Trade. They'd come into the desert for a little bit. No, they were going somewhere else for their training, but they were sent to help, they were brought to the desert when Rommel broke through. They had not been in action, and when they went into action, they didn't go very far before they met German fire, these 88 millimetres again, and they turned about and went back again. So all we saw was some dust advancing and then retreating. And that happened both on the left flank and the right flank. In other words, we did not get the tank support that we had expected, so we were sitting out there like Aunt Sally's. The British brigade, which were to come from the left across our front, ran into all sorts of trouble. They got caught up in their own wire and so on. By the time they reached their objective, the entire brigade had been annihilated with the exception of two people who got through to their objective and were taken prisoner. So we were still out there on our own. Then we thought we saw daylight coming. Tanks were coming from the right front, and they appeared to be our tanks. We thought they were Churchill's, so we felt that something was happening in our favour. At this point, our very excellent soldier, Jimmy Allen, who was adjutant and a captain, and regarded to be the one man in the battalion who would get the first VC, he was that type of gung-ho, probably around about 28 years old, something like that. He was in charge of Don Company. He got the bright idea that if he could get a vehicle, that he would go out and meet the tanks and guide them into our position. One of the only anti-tank guns, the six-pounders that came through, was pretty close to B Company. He commandeered the vehicle and raced past, and just beyond my sanger, my weapon pit, probably 75 yards out, something like that, a shell, German shell, landed underneath and blew him out of the vehicle. And he landed on his back. So, actually, without giving it any thought, I immediately raced across to him to see what I could do. But I found that he was very badly injured. He was split right up through the body, very badly split. And it was wide open, very deep, and even hadn't started bleeding. It was so deep at this point. And he asked me to shoot him, and I said, don't worry, Jim. In any event, I didn't have my revolver. I just jumped straight out without any weapon at all to go across to him. So I went back to my sanger. There was nothing I could do. In the middle of the battle, I didn't have a band big enough. You wouldn't do it with a normal pack. And we had no RAP man with us, first aid man. And the tanks were coming closer and closer. They're getting pretty close by this time. And, of course, the firing was still going on around us. So the then company commander, Johnny Hall, said, what's happening? And I said, Jim's badly hit, and he wants me to shoot him. And he said, you can't do that. And, of course, you can't. You know, when you stop and think of it, you can't do it. But by this time, the tanks were really getting close to us. And problem is, they were Churchill's that had been captured by the Germans. They were using our tanks. And so Jimmy Allen's confusion was understood. And they got very right on us by this time. Well, now, at around about this time, our battalion commander, who was very experienced, although he'd only been with us 4 days, put a call through to the artillery, our own artillery, to send a box barrage down around us. It was a little bit late in coming. The tanks came on us. They were staggered, so in other words, a row of tanks with another row in the gaps behind them to cover the front tanks. The tank that came directly to my sanger had an officer in it with a machine gun. He had the conning tower up, or at least the top up, and he was there with a machine gun. He was saying, "Aus, aus, aus." Well, I had, at some risk, taken with me, I had a revolver, from a lieutenant that had been killed a couple of days before, and I had a sticky bomb, which was one of these things like a very, very large toffee apple with a metal casing over it. And you had a pin that you pulled, which released the cover, and then you had this very large sticky bomb in your hand. So then you went up to the tank, and you planted it on the side of the tank. Then you raced out of the way while it exploded on the tank. Well, If it had been hit by a bullet during the night, I would have been in great trouble. But it didn't. But there was no way that I could put that sticky bomb with when you've got a machine gun looking at you and he's saying, I was. So prior to this, I tried to do what I could. I got rid of an enemy compass I had, because that didn't incriminate me. I tried to destroy my Smith & Wesson revolver, but they're made of very strong stuff, and there's nothing that I have that could do anything to that. So next fellow said, "For you, the war is over. Aus, aus, for you, the war is over." Well, it's a pretty logical thing. There's nothing you could do. So I got my hands up, and then I bent down. I took a bit of a risk here, too, when I think of it. I bent down and picked up my haversack, which is a little bit interesting, as might come later. But he didn't mind my doing that, obviously. And then we all were put into a column and taken off. March is not quite the road. I suppose we were marched, but certainly not in step. As we were going through, then our artillery barrage came down, and we got more casualties. And there was one particular case of a private jumping into a trench, and a shell came straight after him. Of course, obviously, that was the end of him. We got through to the other side, and then we were marched off to vehicles and taken to our first camp. Now, when we were marching off, at this time, I was pretty keen. I knew that I had an OCTU coming up, and I wanted to get to it. And of course, everyone wanted to escape. So I drifted back to the end of the column, all the time looking for an opportunity. And back at the end, I found our adjutant, Lex Lamb, who was also a good soldier. But his father had been in the first 28th in the First War and done extremely well. He was an ambitious young captain, I think, at this stage, lieutenant or captain. And I think he saw himself getting battalion command later, and I think it was frustrating his career. And he, believe it or not, was crying. So then I had a little bit more sympathy for the Italian's officers I'd seen crying when I had to take him to a camp a little bit earlier.
What had happened to the wounded? Were they just left?
Well, the as far as Jimmy Allen was concerned, I kept looking at him. Very shortly after I got back, I'd look across and I saw Jimmy put his hand across his eyes, because the sun was starting to get up by this time. He had his hand across his eyes. I saw it move once or twice, and then it stopped. An interesting thing, while talking about Jimmy Allen, some years later, it would have been in January 48, I was on the beach on Bondi in Sydney, and I heard some people who'd been over with the Wargrave Commission, and they'd been to Ruin Ridge. And I heard them say that they'd found the body of Jimmy Allen. And I heard one say to him, "How do you know it was Jimmy?" They said, "Because he had his MC, and that would be right. He had the MC ribbon." So at least I know what happened to Jimmy. And his son came here about a month ago and with his wife, and we had quite a pleasant day, and I was able to tell him a lot of these things, what a great soldier his father was, which in truth he was. Well, we're all moving off, and there was my sense of being a prisoner was one of total frustration too. I didn't get round to crying, but it's something that I hadn't considered for a moment. I think I mentioned this perhaps in an earlier tape, that I'd thought of getting my face blown off or losing my my manhood. Or even losing an arm or a leg or something, I'd never thought of being taken prisoner. And I don't know of any soldiers that I have spoken to who really considered it as being an option, a viable option. But it's pretty obvious there are some situations you have no alternative but to surrender. So then we moved off and we went to our first camp. I think it was El Daba. And it was just an ordinary wire transit camp. And we had to lie on the ground. And they brought in B big drums of water, 44-gallon drums of water, water equivalent. And by this time, the officers had been removed, the warrant officers were in charge, but no real command had taken place at that point. So everybody rushed the water, and most of it was wasted. The following day, we were handed over to the Italians, and we spent the night at Mersa Matru in the camp there. So then the warrant officers decided that water wasn't going to be wasted again, so we actually took over the drums and everybody had to line up and get their fair share. So by the time it became dark, they'd thrown in a pretty large tarpaulin, but there's nowhere to sleep except I got a little bit of a corner of that. Then over came the planes, British planes, up went the AK-AK. A piece of shrapnel came down, and I'd been watching it with my head in my helmet, watching it, and this bit went off, and I thought, oh, that won't hit me. I turned my head into my helmet on the side. Down came what we call the boy on the bike, the and bang, it did. Big as bit as your fist, and just the edge caught me there. If my head had been straight on, if I'd been looking up, well, it would have crushed straight through. That's sort of real luck, and I was the only person who was wounded in that issue. So then we were taken up to Brook. And that was a very emotional moment for us because we'd been there for the siege for 6 months. And to be there as prisoners in our Tobruk was humbling, is not the word, it was a frustrating, more than humbling, it was a frustrating experience. But there was nothing we could do about it, except wonder how those bloody South Africans, there were so many of them, how they could hand it over the way we believed they did. Just handed it over. And there we were, in Tobruk, out of Tobruk as prisoners. So you can imagine yourself how we felt. So then we went up through Derna to Benghazi, which was a main camp. And that's from where the old Benghazi handicap that Rommel started when he came down the coast. At the beginning of Tobruk in 41, April 41. The Palms was run, by this time we'd been handed over to the Italians, and things weren't too good. There'd been a lot of prisoners or a lot of activity through that camp over a couple of years. The sand, which was normally pretty fine, was fine as dust, and it was quite thick. And at night, we had to lie down. You had nothing else. You had to lie down in that fine powder dust. You'd wake up in the morning with your ears clogged and your nose clogged and your mouth and your eyes. You can just picture, just put a lot of dust on the ground and go and lie in it and sleep in it all night and see how you feel in the morning. We had no toilet paper. We had none of those amenities. I guess I was a bit fortunate because of my head wound, I had a bandage wound around my head. So for my toiletry, I was able to tear off at least a little bit of bandage to help me through that. The strongest memory I have is one of surprise and disgust at a lot of our own people as prisoners, in that the Italians would come and throw food over the wire, and they'd be standing there with their cameras taking shots while Australian soldiers and others were rushing in, grabbing and fighting over the food. I found that absolutely unbelievable. Couldn't believe it could happen. But there it was, and it did. There's another instance I'm not quite clear on my mind now, but one fellow tried to escape, and he was strung up on the wire, and he was there all day. As a warning to others. Well, it was a pretty unhappy sort of a situation. We were there until the 16th, and then a good number of us were, including members of our battalion, my battalion, 2nd 28th, were to be sent by ship to Italy. Well, I was given the task. I always got pulled out for these things, because perhaps because I was looked so young, I suppose. I don't know, but anyway, there I was. And I had to form up and march them aboard Benino Bixio, which I did. I had a companion from my even pre-army, pre-war days, from the 2nd 11th Battalion, who was company quartermaster sergeant of C Company. He had joined up with me, and and for the next 2.5 years, he was my second in command, you might say, whatever I had to do. When we moved aboard the ship, I, of course, led, and we went, once on the ship, we went to a hold which had a long ladder running right down to the bottom of the bows of the ship. And it was indicated to me that I had to walk down it. I looked, decided I wouldn't, walked around to the next one, which was a shorter ladder going to the mezzanine part of the hold, and there I was directed to go down the long one to fill up the bottom. But I said to Makaki, Bill McCoy, my mate, I said, well, I'm buggered if I'm going down there, and he said, I'm buggered if I am either. So we both drew back into the bridge, the bulkhead, in the dark, or semi-dark, while the rest of the troops filled up down to the bottom layer and then filled up the mezzanine layer. And then off we went.
Before we go off on this particular trip, I wanted to ask you, during your time in North Africa being transported to Benghazi and then off, had you seriously thought of escape? Was there hope that you might be relieved, for instance?
Well, constantly. I don't know. There's no thought in my mind that I can consciously recall of being relieved, because the further we penetrated through into, you might say, German enemy lines, it became more and more remote. But escape was constantly on my mind, and I was constantly aware of, if I were to run, where would I run to, where was the cover, how would I get away from there. This was constantly in my mind. It never stopped being in my mind all the way through, but no opportunity came, because the desert's a pretty big place and you just can't go running off by yourself. Really, I suppose some people might, but it didn't seem practical to me. And so, and others no doubt had their own thoughts, but I really hadn't discussed it with them.
And I wanted to discuss this sort of idea that you're involved in a big game and now you're it, off the field sort of attitude.
Well, I think I might have given that idea to you earlier about when you're at war, 1 minute you're fighting somebody, and then when they're the prisoner or you're the prisoner. It is sort of something like that, but I guess in actual battle it's not quite like that, because it's a pretty serious thing. You know, you really do have your life on the line. And it's not like getting into a boxing match and you might get a decent whack behind the ear, but it's not as if you're going to be seriously maimed or lose your life or something. So there's a different content there. But when the battle is not rolling and you have an enemy, or you are the enemy and you are with somebody, that person then becomes more of a one-to-one. And your interaction with that person depends very much on the type and mentality of the person themselves, whether he's like that Italian with the four children who we're trying to kill him 1 minute and the next minute we're marching off to the jeeps to take us back in to the carriers, or to the German who in the truck who apologized for handing us over to the Italian, things like that. You know, there's this element of humanity underneath people being at war with each other, and in a remote sense, in a close sense, they do become more realistic, more real as individuals. But that's a generality. It certainly doesn't apply to all people, and you get a lot of people on both sides in all wars, all armies, who can be quite different from that.
Your position as a warrant officer in a prisoner of war situation, how does that position change in relation to the way you're connected to the men?
Well, in the Australian Army, not much, because you've been trained and you're into a position, and you still mentally carry your rank around with you, and other people carry their image of your rank around with them also. Where I found it helped in one particular case is that at El Daba, when we were going into the prison camp there and we were being searched, and a young Italian, he was a young Italian, and I had to pull out all my papers, whatever, and I came upon the last thing that I'd been given before we went into action in Ruin Ridge, and it was a message for the company commander, which showed all the enemy positions and our positions. I put it in my pocket. He was running late. We went straight out to the start line, into action. I'd forgotten all about it. And suddenly, there it was in this fella's hand. So, without really thinking about it, I just reached out and took it from his hand and said, oh, that won't interest you. He wouldn't have understood what I was talking about. And I just tore it up into small pieces. Now, I think the fact that a company sergeant major in the warrant officer in the Australian Army only has a small crown on his sleeve. It's only a pretty small crown. The British have the wreath around it, which makes it look more impressive. I doubt if this fellow would have seen it, or probably even recognised what it was. So in that particular case, I think it helped me a lot. In the other cases, but as far as the troops are concerned, they respect your position.
Does your role change in relation to sort of backing up the other men?
Yes, of course. Well, there didn't seem to be a great issue initially as prisoners in the early stages. It came more after, mentioned later, after being torpedoed and then getting into Italy and Germany, and with time going on and various deprivations. But as far as the time the desert was concerned, you still carried on your rank and you still had your authority. An interesting thing, I suppose, was that in Benghazi, two things happened. Firstly, the officers were with us in a different compound. And a left-hand friend of mine said, he knew that I had my haversack. He said, could I borrow your razor? And I said, certainly, Hugh. So I gave it to him, lent it to him. That razor went round all the officers, who all shaved themselves, and it got back to me as blunt as old Harry. The other thing was that I had a Reader's Digest in it, and it spoke of what to do in the event of being at sea and being torpedoed or being on a... It made me do two things. I thought, first of all, right, I'm a prisoner. Now, what's the position? What's my position? And I came to these conclusions. I expect to be a prisoner for 2 years, and I knew I had to do two things. I had to look after my mind, and I had to look after my health. And if I do those things, I would get through. I knew it was, I was expecting it not to be easy. I was expecting it to be tough. I was expecting I could handle it, but I had to keep my mind and my body in good health. And I must say, I put that to good purpose, because I did a whole range of things. I read as much as I could, and always the best books I could get. I got involved in a whole range of the condition of man, especially religion. I spoke religion with every priest, rabbi, whatever. And also as far as exercise, I used to run PT schools. We got some boxing classes for it. Boxing tournaments, a whole range and things like that. And in fact, I stopped running the morning exercise program with a small group when we used to pump water up from a deep well, and it became so cold that you'd pour it over yourself, and then there wasn't the food in us to really survive, to get back the warmth. So we just had to stop that. That's another interesting aspect about, and as I'm pushing it a bit, this is towards the last period in the war, when the German rail was all knocked out, you know, the bombers were coming over, and the Russians were advancing, and over winter, Germany was using all their transport, to train transport particularly, to get their supplies up to the front, to their respective fronts. They had no room for POWs' food parcels, which were a pretty infrequent thing at the best of times. So we got very, very hungry. And it was interesting that in that point of hunger, all you use all your flesh. You can't sit on your bottom for too long because the bones are just hard and so on. That's sort of an interesting time.